Hey, Chris here with a quick note before we get into the episode. We had some audio issues on this one, so my audio does not sound quite as good as it normally does. I apologize for that, and it'll be all fixed up for the next one.
Six.
Chris, the topic we'll be discussing today is, do you create in-game documents for your players? Can I get a yes or no answer real quick?
Oh, yeah. I'm going to waffle on this one for a little bit.
Okay, good.
Hello and welcome to Roll for Topic, a roundtable discussion about topics related to running role-playing games. I'm Chris Salzman.
And I'm Andy Rowe.
Andy, we were on this call a little bit earlier, kind of chit-chatting. I think we're both in like the doldrums, if you will.
Yes.
But that's fine. We're going to pull it around and we're going to get excited about talking about role-playing games right now.
We sure are.
Yeah. Before we do that, though, I did want to check in on sort of the perennial question of like, what are we reading? What are we reading these days? So I just finished a book called Ancillary Justice. Have you read this at all?
I have, yes.
Is it Anne Leike?
Leike? I don't know. Leike? I'm not sure how to pronounce it.
Yeah. So this is a book that I really loved sort of the core idea of and a lot of the ideas in it. And I just found it to be like kind of a slog to get through, which surprised me because it's solid sci-fi. There's lots of amazing sort of hints at this like grander world and stuff. There's like a really good setup for the main character being this sort of like hive mind AI thing that can run ships. And it's got all the stuff that should make it great. And I just for some reason it didn't quite click with me. But what I'm finding is talking with a lot of other people is that it very much clicked with them and they loved it. It's like one of their favorite book and book series. What was your experience? What's your experience with that?
Yeah. Well, first I want to just acknowledge, I think it is an underappreciated, but completely valid thing to just not be into something as much as everybody else is.
Yeah, right.
Like if everybody else likes the Marvel movies and you don't, like it doesn't mean you're missing something critical about the Marvel movies. It just means it just didn't appeal to you. My experience, so I had a similar experience. I was a little meh on it, but I felt bad being meh on it. When I read it, I had just read a lot of Ian Banks's culture novels.
Oh, wow, yeah.
And I am not saying that Anne Leike's novel like steals ideas from the culture, but there were a lot of just like parallel ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And those had been, I had just finished exploring those at some length in the culture novels. And as a result, I didn't feel, it was hard to feel engaged when a lot of those similar concepts about like the reach of empire and about kind of that question of identity, those weren't as compelling to me simply because I had just read a series of novels that are about those same ideas.
Yes. Yeah.
So I enjoyed it, but like I never moved on to book two. So.
Yeah. It was about, I was like 3/4 of the way through and that's the first time that I learned that this was a series. At that point, and like, you know, a lot sort of happens in the last, I would say probably 50 pages of that book, like to set up sort of what's going to come next. And I think I have this experience more and more the older I get of, and this is very strange, like I don't really like series books as much anymore. Like I find myself just sort of like, well, I want to read like a single story. And I know this again, like going back to like everybody else likes Marvel movies. I know everybody else loves this, right? this concept, right? Like you can read this book and then there's seven more to read after that. Yeah. And I think like there's just something about it that, especially okay, this is setting up the sequel and like the trilogy or whatever. I don't know how many of the books are. I was happy to sort of just read this story.
Well, it makes me think a lot about kind of the golden age of sci-fi, and by mm-hmm. that I mean like the days of Heinlein and mm-hmm. Asimov and Arthur C. Clarke, and like there's a lot of those books are like 250 page, like there's one idea the author mm-hmm. had, it's neat, they devote 250 pages to exploring it, and then that's it. You're done with the idea. Like mm-hmm. it's been fun to explore it.
Yeah.
And like, I feel we have maybe lost a little bit of that that type of sci-fi where it's just like, I have an idea, I want to just play with it for a while. And now, you know, and I say now, but it's probably been this way for a few decades. You know, we want series and sequels and stuff, but like a lot of, sometimes the best ideas don't need to become the basis for like a franchise of novels, right? You can just enjoy the idea for what it is and then call it quits.
Yeah. It's, I mean, I know there's like market realities that go into that. And there's also just like from an author's point of view, right? I'm sure it's super fun to write a series. Like as you're writing it, I'm sure you have a thousand other ideas that you want to explore.
Sure.
Yeah, but I'm sort of with you. It's like, yeah, I'm looking back at the books I've really enjoyed in the past few years have all been sort of standalone. Yeah. Standalone things where it's just like, yeah, there's sort of one idea, it's explored fully, and then it's, yeah, put down, there isn't a sequel. I keep on thinking about Piranesi by Suzanne Clark. I think that's Suzanne Clark. But yeah, like that is just total standalone, right? Like a sequel to that would make no sense, right?
Totally. Yeah, what would you want from a sequel to that, right? Like you've already explored the cool, the amazing idea the author had. Do you expect more amazing ideas from that author? Like, do you want to revisit the one amazing idea that book one already covered? You know, like those are tough questions to answer.
Yeah. Yeah, I do. I also wonder if this sort of relates back to not a problem we necessarily have in like tabletop games, but definitely it's something that I've observed in tabletop games is like, there's so much out there that the thought of playing like only D&D, right, for your entire role-playing career, right? It's just like, well, oh, but you're like, you're missing out on this, that, and other, you know, this, that, and other thing. It's like, I don't know. There's like this sense for me of like, okay, like I've gone and I've explored this thing. Like now I want to go explore the next thing. Right? It's almost just like this sense of like newness or exploring what the breadth of this thing can be. Yeah, because you get exposed to different ideas and exposed to like sort of different, I don't know, different ways of thinking about the hobby, right? And like, and yeah, again, when you're reading books, like let's say getting to read different authors and stuff, I think is a really valuable part of reading. Yeah, which is like just, this is all sort of a very high-minded way of saying like, book was good, probably not going to read another one in the series. Like, I don't need to justify it further, but of course I'm trying to justify it.
Right.
Justify it further. But I'm also wondering if just at this point in my life, if I'm just not into sci-fi anymore. And that is something that like, that's a bigger thing that has kind of taken me aback. Yeah. Cause I feel like I've read a handful of sci-fi things recently where I'm just like, eh, like that just didn't do it for me. Like it used to.
So two things bring to mind. First, whenever I think of this, I think you read this too. There's a Arthur C. Clarke novel, I feel like, that embodies this idea. It's the one about the space elevator.
Yes, I think about that all the time. Yes.
I think about it all the time too. Like it's Arthur C. Clarke had a great idea for a space elevator, and that's an amazing idea.
Yes.
And he wrote this like terrible novel.
Oh.
That like the entire purpose of the novel is just to introduce you to the idea, which is amazing.
I know.
The plot around it means nothing. Like, I don't want a sequel to that novel. Like, he is presented. It's like an idea delivery. Like, it's the sci-fi novel as an idea delivery mechanism. Right?
Yes.
Like, Fountains of Paradise, is that what it was called?
Yeah, I think it's called Fountains of Paradise, which is just like that is signing you up for something that you don't actually get.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's like I think about that a lot because every time anyone says like hard sci-fi, like my mind immediately goes to Arthur C. Clarke's book about space elevator.
Yes.
Yeah, and like again, really good. Like I don't want to read it again. I don't want to read anything else in that. Yeah, and like part of me feels like a little bit like, oh, maybe I've lost some sort of sense of majesty and wonder at the like what technology can do. Don't know why that would have happened, but like, you know, like yeah, it's just you know, you're just like you know, you read something like that and it's like, this is so cool, like can't you imagine us like as a society doing something like that? And maybe I've just gotten jaded to where it's like, nah, I can never see that actually working, right? And so there's that idealism that's sort of at the core of sci-fi, like maybe just doesn't hit. Yeah.
It's like it used to. Should we call it right now? We're never going to get a space elevator.
No, we're never going to. Sorry, Arthur. Yeah.
But the other thing I wanted to respond to was that this might seem a little frivolous, but like maybe 10 years ago. So when I grew up, I always I play a lot of video games, and I always like, this is very dumb. I always thought of myself as a like strategy gamer, like someone who played strategy games, and I would like buy all the new strategy video games that came out and some board games, and I would play them. And maybe about a decade ago, I just had this realization of like, I'm not actually good at these, and I don't really think I enjoy them anymore. Like, for years, I had been buying every new like Civilization game that came out, and I would play it for like 3 hours. My Steam count would be like 3 hours, and then I would never touch it again. It's because like at just some point, it no longer brought me like joy and happiness. Mm-hmm. But there was a long gap between that and then me realizing, oh hey, this isn't like a corner of the hobby that brings me joy anymore. I should just kind of give myself permission to let that go as a beloved part of my past, but not something that I love anymore. And that's what I thought of when you said maybe you're just not into sci-fi anymore, or in the way that you were like 10 years ago or 15 years ago. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah. Do you think you'd ever go back to that? Or is that something that you're mourning, or is it just like a realization like, oh, like I don't have to buy Civilization 7 now.
No, it's still like an itch. Like, so there's a new Civilization game out. Mm-hmm. I haven't bought it, but like I think about buying it, but then I think I bought like the last three Civilizations. I have like, I put like 4 hours into each of them because I played them for a bit but didn't really truly genuinely enjoy it. And yet the itch is still there. There's a new one out. I should get it. Maybe this will be the one. Like, I mean, I've resisted that so far. At some point I will get Civilization because it will be in like a Humble Bundle for like $3 along with 300 other like games that cost $400 million to make. So I still feel it like a phantom limb that like, oh yeah, I like strategy games. Well, no, Andy, no, you don't. You haven't really enjoyed one. You've bought all of them. You bought all like the Age of Empires remakes and everything else that came out, but you don't play them. And when you do, you're not like really loving the experience.
So. Yeah. You're not getting into it like really deeply. And you know, you're not sitting up at night thinking about it or anything. Yeah. Yeah. I think that, I mean, that, you know, that's definitely a sign of maturity, right? Like I think there is, you know, as you grow and mature, right, you should sort of put away the things that aren't exactly serving you anymore. But I mean, I think it can be sad too. It's like, you know, like I feel like in our community, at least, like D&D was the gateway for most of the people I think we interact with, you know, D&D, Pathfinder, right? Pick your, like kind of your fantasy tabletop game of choice. Right. And like, that's what got you in. And then you find yourself being like, well, this isn't exactly what I want anymore. So you start exploring some other games and stuff. And like, for me, like looking at D&D, it's like I have this fondness for it, right? Like I didn't have a negative experience playing it that made me stop playing it. It just was a circumstantial one, right? So like every once in a while, and we talk about it a lot on the podcast, I'm just like, oh, like it'd be really fun to run something like that again, right? And like, yeah, it's like, but it's also like I don't know if it would capture the same magic, right? It's the same reason I'm picking up these sci-fi books and being like, okay, this is going to be the one that's going to get me back into it. It's just like it just doesn't seem to hit. But like every time I read a fantasy novel, I'm like, yes, this is awesome. I want more of this. So,
well, I've had this thought with, I mean, we do a podcast about tabletop RPGs, so like that has to be part of our identity, right? Like it's a thing. And like, you know, but I've gone through phases where I've wondered of like, you know, maybe you should just take like a year and like just not, and just like stop thinking about this particular hobby, or just like let this one go for a little bit or something. Mm-hmm. I don't say that in any sort of bleak way, or to say that like I'm leaving the hobby. Just to say that I think the human brain is weird about how we define our identities. Like we're also primed to identify ourselves through like the hobbies and the kind of extracurricular activities that we pursue, but we don't really have a good process for saying like, this isn't me right now. Maybe it will be me in like a year. It definitely was me 10 years ago, and it like this was a valuable part of my life, but it doesn't need to be a valuable part at every step of my life, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. I'm not going to belabor this too much, but so like I'm in between jobs right now, right? Like, so we had some layoffs at my company. So like I'm doing a lot of thinking about like sort of identity and like what, you know, like who is Chris and yeah, like what do I want?
Yeah.
Want out of life and stuff. And it's like, it is an interesting, it's an inflection point, right? Like in my career to like all of a sudden have sort of like nothing. So it's like, then what are you going to focus on? Right. And like, there's all these hobbies and I've got a little bit of time and that's just like this huge, huge, boon to, you know, to my life and benefit and stuff. Right. So I've got a little bit of time to sort of think through and like maybe explore a few things here and there. And like, it's interesting because like I'm going back into like my resume, right, for instance, and like looking at like all the jobs that I've had and like looking back to like the first company that we worked at together like years and years ago. And it's like, if you put me back in that role, I would be miserable. But like at a time that was like so core to my identity. Mm-hmm. Right. So you have these, yeah, you have these things, right? And same thing with like playing hobby games. Like I used to be a huge board gamer. Like I would, you know, we played board games at least once a week, if not more, you know, more than that. And like, I haven't really played a board game in like maybe a year or two, at this point. And it's not something that like, it's something that I miss, but like I miss it because it used to be something that I did all the time. Not necessarily because I'm like, oh, I have to go play this,
yeah,
this new game. Right. Like, you know, people will mention something. It's like, oh, that sounds interesting. It sounds like this game that I played a lot 10 years ago or whatever. Yeah. But it's also not like, it's not something that I'm like, I need to clear my schedule and make time for this. Right. And I think like that's often for me, that's the tell for, is this important? Is like, are you going to bend heaven and earth to make time and space and energy for this thing? Yeah. And like, if you find that like, wow, like I, you know, like I buy Civilization and then I put, you know, the 3 hours in, so I can't do the return on Steam, you know, it's like, no, it's mine. But then like, I never want to do it ever again. It's like, yeah, that's a good indicator that maybe this isn't quite right for you. Yeah. Same thing with like D&D. It's like, how many books have I bought since the last time that I've run D&D? Like, I'm not going to explore that too much because it's probably way more than I think. Like, how many of the adventure books and source books and stuff like that? It's like, yeah, but it's like, you know, you can be casually interested in it too, but it's also like, well, I mean, at a certain point, maybe you just got to admit that like, this isn't going to happen, you know, at the same level that you might have made it happen 10 years ago. And like, that's okay, right? Like, there's other stuff that you're doing.
Yeah, I mean, one of the weirdnesses is that like D&D and role playing is something you can enjoy on a lot of different levels.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Like you can enjoy it because you are playing it every week. You can enjoy it because you aren't playing regularly. You would kind of like to be. And in the meantime, you're picking up the books to like kind of just keep that, to scratch that itch, right? Mm-hmm. Like to think about how fun it would be to be playing this stuff, you know? And I think in my personal anecdotal experience, there's an awful lot of people in this role-playing hobby who experience it in a way that is not like playing a regular game of it.
Oh yeah, totally. Yeah.
And I think that is great. I think that's great. Like people, I think there's a certain part of this hobby that might react with like sneering of like, well, those people aren't like really doing it right. Right.
Yeah, whatever.
But I'm not here for that. I'm here for like, you know, I mean, as long as it is bringing you joy, like I think it is, you know, you don't need to justify doing it.
Yeah.
Beyond like checking your bank account and making sure you can
afford
to be doing it. But
that brought up one other thought, and I will derail us one step further before we get to our topic. Thinking about things where it's like, this is sort of part of the hobby that isn't actually playing the games. So like, I feel like Kickstarter comes up a lot. Like, you know, it's like we've all Kickstarted a million things that like may or may not have shipped, and like you kind of get surprised sometimes. You're like, oh yeah, I forgot about that. The thing. But so there's one Kickstarter that I kickstarted, I guess this was, I need to look this up, a couple years ago. This was sort of in the wake of the OGL. So I kickstarted this thing called the Cool Name RPG.
Oh.
And this is something that one of my former coworkers and friends actually worked on. Yeah, right? Worked on with like with his group. Yeah, and so like I kind of like I kickstarted it, you know, checked in on the updates here and there, and kind of like forgotten about it. And mainly like I kickstarted it because like the thought was, in the wake of the OGL, we sort of just needed more options for people. Like for yeah. like I want to play heroic fantasy, but I don't want to do D&D because of, you know, various stuff with Wizards of the Coast, right? Yeah, so like I kickstarted it like with sort of that intent. So recently though, they've gotten to the point where they're actually like publishing like the play material and stuff, right? Like they're getting kind of close to finished product and stuff. So this week, I think on maybe when you're listening to this, right, it'll be this day or next week, I'm actually going to play in like a play test. Like
hey, fantastic. Right?
Play test or actual, I don't know, like actual game session of it too. But yeah, it's kind of cool. It's interesting. Like when I kickstarted, I was like, you know, I'm doing this to support the project, like, and like, I will probably check in on it, but not really planning on using this as my game system of choice. But like now, right, it's kind of come around. I'm going to get to play in it too. Yeah. So I'm pretty excited for that. So they kickstarted it as Cool Name RPG, and they just recently announced the actual name of it. They picked it. It's going to be the Open Adventure System, which I like a lot. Huh. Yeah.
Okay. Well, right. I'll have to check that out.
Yeah.
Have you done an official play test of an RPG before?
Only for like, I think friends systems and stuff. But yeah, nothing like where it's like, I don't know, like, yeah, Wizards of the Coast is publishing, like, here's the new D&D edition, go play it with your group. Yeah. It's always like, I'm playing with the person who's writing the game. Yeah.
Have you done that? In any of those sessions, have they, you know, had specific questions that they were trying to answer through the playtest?
I don't think I was ever given like a form to fill out, but there's always been like a discussion afterwards. And I think that's a healthy part of it. Like you're to play the game and then you're like, then you kind of talk about the experience, to let them tune what the game is actually doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, neat. Well, maybe in the next episode, you can just share how that playtest experience went.
Absolutely. Yeah, of course. All right. So let's get to the topic. We've derailed each other enough. Yeah.
This topic actually came to us from a listener. So let me read this was a couple weeks or months ago. Mm-hmm. Time has no meaning anymore. No,
absolutely. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Let me read the message they sent to me. They said that they would be interested in hearing us talk about the question, what are some effective use cases for writing, quote, in-world speeches or documents?
Oh,
in the example this person submitted, I'm writing a poem for the Pendragon adventure I'm writing, which is a curse that a ghost will lay on the PCs. And I'm basing it on an actual curse found in a Norse saga. So already you are like champion tier GM, like far beyond me and Chris here.
But yes. Yeah. That's amazing. And maybe be careful with how you read that curse aloud. If you're using an actual real curse as your starting point. Yeah,
that's right. Test it on something before you put it on your players.
Yeah. So I think, let's see, when I've done this a little bit where I've like written like in-game letters and notes and stuff. It's super fun. Like, yeah, just you go to like a hobby store and you can pick up some fun paper and, you know, like, you know, your calligraphy pen and write a note. So I've done that on occasion, which is super fun. The game that I play in right now with Matt Wilson as the GM, like he's great at handing out props, like he'll print them out and like hand them out. Sometimes he'll put them on this last session, he put them on the table, sort of like underneath our dice tray as like I don't want to forget about this, but just if you take a little bit of time to read those documents you just picked up, you can look at what this is. Well, of course we're going to, which is great. But yeah, it's super fun, I think, getting those sorts of things. And then you can kind of rifle through them and like, yeah, try to figure out what the clues mean and stuff. I think for the GM, what's nice is it gives you this like point at which you're committing to story beats, which can allow you to maybe be a little bit more clever with them than you might if you're trying to improvise it at the table. I don't know. What about you? Yeah. What do you
Yeah. Well, here's my experience with this sort of thing. So I love this sort of thing. I have created my own in-game documents, and I always like it when like a published game provides like documents to hand out to people. My home family in Masks of Nyarlathotep campaign only lasted for about a year before I flaked out on it, but I invested in that time, and like there's a third party company, I think it's called the HP Lovecraft Historical Society, anyway,
yeah.
They produce handouts, like really elaborate time period accurate handouts for different Cthulhu campaigns. So I bought their one for Masks of Nyarlathotep, which it like contains all of the handouts from the published campaign, but just like really lavishly done, right? Mm-hmm. So here's your passport. It's an actual passport that of the sort that they issued in the 1920s.
Oh, that's so cool.
And here's like the actual stamps for the countries you could enter. And then the neat thing about that was they went further than the published campaign by like, so for example, like in the campaign, you can, I'm kind of being a little bit, I'm smoothing over some details here, but like, mm-hmm. early in the campaign, you might want to find the medical records for somebody you're investigating. Mm-hmm. Well, like in the game itself, that's a role, you know, you make your role, bureaucracy role, to talk to the hospital into giving the campaign, into mm-hmm. giving you the medical records. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, there's like two clues that you learn from it that the GM will say, like, okay, you read the medical records and you learn these things.
Yeah.
Well, like I paid for this deluxe thing and there's like a, you know, the 30 pages of medical records are reproduced.
Oh my goodness.
So, so I love that sort of thing, but it also, but interestingly, you know, like, so that has changed your interaction with this piece of evidence, right? Mm-hmm. If you're playing it without the prop, you would make a bureaucracy role or maybe a medicine role. And I would tell you what you learned that was important from those documents.
Yes.
And maybe if you botched your role, I wouldn't tell you a couple of key things, right? Mm-hmm. But now instead of that, I'm handing you the actual document, and like, yeah. you can, in between games, you should read through these 30 pages and figure out for yourself what the important clues are from that. Mm-hmm. I love that. It like, it didn't work the way I dreamed it would at my game.
Yeah.
Partly because I'm playing with a teenager. Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot of like, well, this was really addressed in that 30 pages of documentation I gave you. Like, you're stuck. You don't know where to go. It's because you didn't really read.
What, the why didn't you read the 30 pages of right. medical records?
You didn't read those very carefully, did you? So yeah. it comically ended up coming back to me, the GM, like telling them the important things to learn yeah. from the document. So
yeah.
that's my really long-winded thing. My other example is one I'm positive I've shared on this podcast before, but we're enough years into this that I think I can assume people yeah, maybe fine. Haven't listened to everything. My favorite example of an in-game document, it was some sort of document like a poem or a epic verse or something like that. And the physical document was important because so I wrote this document out on like nicely aged paper. Mm-hmm. And then I took a needle and I poked holes under certain letters, uh-huh. which if you held them up to like a light source or the sun, you would see, oh, some of these letters have holes poked under them. They spell their own message, which is different, which is yeah. the real clue that we need.
That's amazing.
This was like 100% bomb. Nobody yes. like understood it at the table.
Yeah.
And I ended up saying like, why didn't you hold that up to the light? Like, okay, that didn't work. Do you see anything? Look closer. Like, and then it was a gloriously humiliating GMing experience that wound up with me saying, well, you examine it and you notice that a lot of like the some mm-hmm. of the letters have pinpricks under them and you get the clue.
Yes. Did anyone like gasp with delight when you told them that detail, or were they just like, oh, Andy?
I've blocked it out of
yeah.
This was 9 years ago.
So. I mean, it's a brilliant idea for a prop. It sort of reminds me. So I'm reading The Hobbit with my daughter. Still, we're getting sort of to the end of it, but like the lengths at which Tolkien goes to sort of explain like that there's a hidden message on the map that they've been yes. carrying around, and like Elrond reads it to them, and then they spend like weeks like trying to like look around the mountain just to find like the door, and then they spend like all this time trying to figure out how to open the door. It's just like, yeah, it's like you can just see a D&D party, like, yeah, or like your tabletop party just being like, I don't know what to do next here, and it's like the GM kind of interceding.
Yes. Didn't, do you remember anyone? Well, you've got that map that you remember got that 6 months map? Ago from yeah. Elrond, remember?
Yeah, and I remember Elrond said there was a special thing. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, no, yes. No shade to Bilbo and the dwarves, but like, yeah, that's a it's a very D&D style thing. Yeah, okay. So this is reminding me, like, again, I'm sure I've talked about this in the podcast. Years and years and years ago, I ran this murder mystery with a friend where it was like a multi-location murder mystery that we did. This is the sort of thing you can do in your 20s when you have infinite time.
Of course.
No, yes. So we wrote, like, everybody had these huge, like, backstories, everybody who played. Yeah, and then we enlisted a couple friends to come, like, to pretend to be, like, actors. Like, they acted out, like, a couple of NPCs and stuff that we run into as we're running around. And so, like, super, a lot of fun. But the part that, like, I just really loved was I wrote this, like, very dumb series of poems. So, like, there was a clue hidden in a bookshelf somewhere. And so I just wrote the series of poems that it was just like one poem would lead to one book, and then there'd be another one in there that would lead you to another book and stuff like that. Like, kind of go around the bookshelf until you finally, like, end up on the one that you wanted to. Like, again, they could brute force it if they wanted to by taking all the books off the bookshelf and, like, flipping through every page, but, like, it would have taken them super long time to do. And there was one person who played in that game who sort of discovered that, like, that was a clue, and it was like they got so focused and, like, trying to figure out each of the poems. Ooh. And, like, figure it out, and, like, so everybody else is milling around doing other stuff, right? They're looking for other stuff, or, you know, talking to people like that, and there's just this one player just got super focused on, like, figuring it out, and, like, I just stood there and watched because I was like, well, I gotta see how this works, and it was just utterly delightful, like, seeing that kind of go off without a hitch. Oh, like, you know, because nothing about it was super hard. It was just you needed someone to sort of pay attention to it for a little bit. And I think, like, so I think about that experience of, like, the, you know, if you can give someone sort of a concrete task to do, right, like, that can be sort of in game, I think that can work really, really well. Like, the 30 pages of medical documents, like, if you handed me those, I would probably do it, but that's only because, like, I trust you as a person.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, that, like, you're giving me something that's going to be useful, but, like, I most likely wanted to be like, well, how about you give me two pages and, like, underline things in it that I really need to pay attention to. But I mean, that stuff is just like, it's so cool. And it adds so much, like, immersion at the table, and it doesn't need to be a whole lot. Like, yeah. So listener who wrote in with this question. Yeah. I mean, like, just rewriting that curse a little bit and, like, yeah, printing it out and, you know, just pick a font, right? Like, you don't even have to handwrite it or anything. Like, printing that out and handing them to at the table, like, that's huge, right? Even if something you're just going to read that's block text in there anyway, like, yeah, just having a little bit of that immersion can help so much for people placing themselves.
Yeah, that was my thought too. Like, this sort of thing in my experience has, like, a way disproportionate positive effect on the game. Like, mm-hmm. Like a hand, like, whatever, you find a note in the goblin hideout that, like, that reveals the identity of the true villain, right? If you can, I don't know why, but, like, you can tell that to the PCs and that's fine. You find the note and it has the, and it's a goblin writing to the real mastermind, mm-hmm. and now you know it is. But, like, I don't know why it is, but it's just 10 times more awesome when you hand them in your own dumb handwriting a goblin note scrolling, yes. Right? I'm sure there's something our brains are doing, like, about this, and I don't know if I want to call it immersion, because, well, immersion's, like, a weird word that gets used in tabletop RPGs, but, like, it's mm-hmm. not like, I mean, it's not like it's helping me imagine that I'm there, but it's just, it's giving me something to engage with, and, like, people love to be given something to tinker with, to, like, try to interpret, to try to play mm-hmm. with, you know?
It gives you something concrete at the table where, like, you know, so much is happening in your imagination all the time. Right. So I think, like, yeah, you hand someone that and it can really solidify the plot point or the clue for them. Like, cause it, like, I think there's, like, a physicality to it, right? Like, you're just like, oh, I'm looking at this thing and it's telling me who the big bad villain is. Like, and that information can stick almost a little bit better. Yeah. You know, like, yeah, again, like, you could have the best goblin accent in the world that you're delivering that information to, but if you just hand him a piece of paper too with a note scrawled on it, I think there's just a ton, a ton there that does engage our brains in a way. Yeah, and I think it's also probably like maybe the games that we play, you're not really handing out a lot of stuff either. Like if you handed them, I don't know, if you kept handing them medical records, right? Like 30-page medical records and there was like nothing in them, right? Like then it becomes almost like homework or a chore, right? Yeah. But like you give someone something, it's like there is a clue in here. Like you can find the clue if you just take the time to do it, right?
It's
like
a that, new kind of game to play.
Yeah, it's, yeah, like it's a new
a little, yeah.
Yeah, it's a little mini game, a little like side quest, and people absolutely love those things. Like it's sort of as fun to write it as it is to decode.
Yeah, I know the question is not about like in-game puzzles, but I feel like if you're handing people like, you know, a poem from your setting, the odds are probably pretty good that there's something that the players need to solve or discover or a connection they need to make using that thing. It's like it's a toy for them to play with that's going to produce something.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't... If your in-game document is like not connected to a thing they need or want to do, if they can't do anything with it except add to their knowledge about like the setting, for example, to me, that's not as exciting. I'm not saying you should never do it, but to me, the joy of like handing people a physical handout is that they all know that you are signifying to them that this is important, that you want them to play with it, and that they'll be rewarded for doing so, right?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think if it's just like an immersion thing, it's, I don't know, it's like playing a video game where you kind of pick up like trash items that don't really do anything for you. It's like, okay, well, I guess that's fine, but unless I'm getting an achievement for this later on, like I don't really care to keep picking these things up.
Well, that's funny you should mention video games. So my teenager is a big Skyrim player. And if you've ever played Skyrim, or some of the other Bethesda games, they are full of in-game documents of startling depth.
Yeah.
So there's hundreds of books in Skyrim and you can read those books. Like you pick up a book and it will have like a story from Skyrim's mythology in it, like multiple pages. Like my teenager collects those books and reads them because they love the lore and stuff. But I think what most people do is you like read one of those and then you're like, okay, this is just background stuff. Like, I don't need to know this. I will not be reading these from now on, right? Yeah. Or I'll be skimming the first page, but there's no way I'm reading like 25 pages on the history of your fantasy country, right? I mean, so I'm not saying, so like my teenager is someone for whom that sort of background stuff is awesome. I think my experience is more normal where I'm like, okay, this is neat. I'm impressed that you went to this effort, but like, I'm also not going to read these 25 pages. So thinking back further, in the old D&D had a thing that I haven't seen much in newer D&D, which is like puzzles, which is actual puzzles to solve that are often like well-known human puzzles that we all know. Like I'm going to skip out of our tabletop RPGs and talk about early text adventures like Zork. So Zork games are full of puzzles, you know, like, oh, if I light the paper on fire, it makes the goblin irritated because it's too hot. And then he drops the thing that I need. Like those are sort of like silly puzzles. There was a Zork game that came along. It's called Zork Zero. And instead of all of those like fantasy garbage puzzles, which I love and was very used to.
Yes.
Most of the puzzles were actual real life games, like Towers of Hanoi, or they were actual real life logic puzzles, like how do you, like, there's two doors and one person always lies and one person always tells the truth.
Yeah.
And when I was younger, I was irritated when I played that game that I was being, I felt like cheated because I knew these puzzles already. But older me thinks it would be like pretty fun to say, to get through this, you have to solve this like Forgotten Realms themed version of Towers of Hinoe.
Yeah.
Like, here you go. Like, here's the towers. Like, I want to see you solve the puzzle.
Yeah.
I don't know, even know where I'm going with this, but like the joy of like interacting with a game or a puzzle, I think is it just, if you can not have that be a single die roll against somebody's intelligence stat or something, I mean, it doesn't matter if it's like Towers of Hinoe and everyone has played it before. It's still more memorable to make someone play Towers of Hinoe than to say, okay, make me like a DC 15 intelligence check and then you solve the puzzle.
Yeah. No, I agree. I agree quite a bit. Yeah. I mean, I think like we have veered off topic a little bit, but I think it all sort of relates back to like, yeah, just the sense of like, you want to add something to your game. It's like, right. You can just play a game where you're telling a story together. But like, I think anything that you can add at the table that isn't going to, you know, take you millions of hours to put together, cause you know, who knows if they'll actually use it or not, can just add so much. So much to the table. So it's like, yeah, for sure. Print out that poem, you know, the curse that you're looking at. Like, yeah, like I think Andy, like your point of like, just play a game that everybody knows, it's fine. Or like, I don't know, invent something easy, like a little dexterity game where you have to flick something across a table, right? It's like, I don't know.
Yeah,
it doesn't have to be a whole lot. If you can tie it back to your fiction in a little way, it just adds a ton to the experience.
Make your poem have whatever, an anagram in it that would, in real life, you would never do because that's so easy to solve. But how fun is it to do that in D&D when you get a poem and like, hey, the first letter of every stanza spells out the keyword to get into the secret base. Like, right? That's really fun.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It spells out like, yeah, whatever. Like, Silver Staff is the big, bad, evil guy. it's like, it doesn't matter. Right. Like, it matters, but it doesn't matter how like cheesy it is. Like, it doesn't need to be this highly produced thing. Especially for a game with your friends. It's like, that stuff's going to hit harder anyway, if it's like a little silly.
Exactly.
So go for it. But all right, okay, so we should wrap it up there. This has been a really good discussion. Thanks to the listener who sent that one in. It was a good discussion, but I think that'll do it for us. So we are Roll for Topic. We're part of the Roll for It Media Podcasting Network. Our sister show, The Splat Book, is great. Go check them out at thesplatbook.com. You should also go check out Zombie Strains with Andy and John. They're not part of our network, but we still love them because it's Andy's podcast. So I'm behind. I know you recently did Shaun of the Dead, which is one of my favorite movies of all time. So I need to go listen to that and see what you got wrong and what you got right.
Waiting for you to tell me what we got wrong. You're the biggest fan of Shaun of the Dead, I think, that I know. So
yeah, that's I believe. When John told me that you guys were going to do this podcast, I was like, when you do Shaun of the Dead, invite me on as a guest. And then later on, he was like, well, we decided not to do any guests, so you can't come on, but we are going to do Shaun of the Dead.
We will accept angry listener emails, though, so if you want to get to work on that.
Good stuff. All right, well, that does it for us. I have been Chris Salzman.
I've been Andy Rao.
Remember, if your players are having fun, you're a great GM.